Good evening, folks, and welcome back. I'm your host, Mark Call, and it's time to take a look back over this week that included the Thanksgiving Day holiday and ask ourselves, where are we and where the heck is the world and especially this nation going? And with that in mind, I guess we ought to start at the usual Friday day after Thanksgiving stories. And perhaps, in hindsight, this really does give us an indication of just exactly what a harbinger, a milepost, a warning sign looks like. Because for a number of years now, Black Friday has been marked by the kind of pandemonium, even violence, that marks the descent of a nation and a world into a place where, I guess you could end up saying, every day looks a lot like Black Friday. And what does that look like? Maybe we should start with an external view. Here's the headline from the Daily Mail out of the UK entitled, Black Friday Mayhem. One shot outside a Missouri mall as brawls close Alabama shopping center after stores open their doors early, with experts predicting Americans will splash out $20 billion over the weekend. While the average shopper is expected to spend about $1,000 on discounted goods in stores and online. Yes, observe the Brits. Black Friday madness has officially gripped America, and the elbows-out shopping bonanza began a little bit earlier than it has in previous years, pretty much now on Thursday evening, as stores across the country opened their doors early to crowds of frantic and sometimes even violent bargain hunters. And within hours, there were mass brawls at malls as they fought over discounted televisions and clothes, and the chaos continued into the daylight hours on Friday. In keeping with the Black Friday zombie apocalypse, reports Tyler Durden and Zero Hedge, media commentator Mark Dice traveled to Walmarts and other stores to document the zombie apocalypse of what he called half-awake consumers hell-bent on elbowing past their peers so they can be sure to get the best deals on electronics, books, video games, clothes, and any number of other popular holiday gift items. And, of course, as Dice points out, many of the same deals can also be found online, anywhere from Amazon to other web retailers, without the hassle of pushing through crowds. But after last year's disappointing end of the Obama regime sales totals, retail analysts expect holiday weekend shopping and spending to come roaring back this year. According to Fox Business, and I guess we'll see, folks, because these projections always tend to be a bit optimistic of late, it seems, spending per capita is expected to climb 47% compared to last year's holiday weekend, up from $505 on average per person to $743, and an estimated 164 million people are planning to shop or are considering shopping during the Thanksgiving weekend, according to a survey by the National Retail Federation. In a rare positive bit of news for America's beleaguered retailers, Americans had already spent over $1.5 billion, or a 17% increase from last year. The warm autumn has meant fashion sellers, in particular, are looking to offload masses of unsold coats, boots, and woolens. But for everyone who isn't participating in the retail madness, plenty of videos and images have already emerged across the nation from social media and news sites of brawls, fistfights, and stampedes, not only in the U.S., but around the world, as the traditional, Black Friday hysteria sets in. And yet, all may not be quite as it seems. Another piece from Zero Hedge says, I was expecting more people, and notes that Black Friday has tumbled officially to the number 3 spot in the busiest shopping days of the year. Oh, and if you're curious what that means, it now falls in behind the Saturday before Christmas and Cyber Monday, according to the consulting firm Customer Growth Partners. Yes, this story begins. It's been an odd year for retail. What with an estimated 6,000 store closures and 65,000 fewer retail jobs than at the start of the year, many investors have started shorting retail, and especially malls. Indeed, they note the performance of the mall-heavy CMBX6 BBB- tranche of bonds confirms that the bottom has simply fallen out of the legacy bricks-and-mortar space. And yet, despite what should be a furious race to the bottom for market share by all still solvent non-Amazon retailers, This has not happened in what appears to be a strange manifestation of rational pricing. Imagine that. In fact, according to MarketTrack, last year the discounts were 6% deeper when it came to Black Friday than this year. Across 17 different categories of ad circulars for Black Friday, reports the Wall Street Journal. And they note that only 3 of 10 major retailers the firm measured had better prices this year than last. And here your host can't help but interject, hey folks, remember Pavlov's dog? Once the dog gets conditioned to hearing that bell ring, you don't even have to provide food anymore, and they'll slobber all over the place. I guess retail shoppers, having been well conditioned over the last few years, are still out in mass, waiting for that bell to ring and looking to slobber all over something. They quote a couple of shoppers around the nation who note, I'm not sure that this year seems extra special. But they did get interviewed at malls now, didn't they? Yes, there are still deals to be had, says the story. On Friday, retailers dangled the usual promotions, many of which were identical to last year, including 30% off at Coach and 50% off at The Gap. But as the Wall Street Journal also confirmed, in spite of the zombie madness some places, lines at many places around the country were far shorter, if present at all, compared to prior years. They have pictures of a number of places to make that point. And it says this, naturally, in light of the smaller bargains, the lack of shopper euphoria is understandable. Yet what's surprising is why there aren't bigger bargains. After all, neither the industry nor the economy has turned on a dime. Speculating about the whys of it all, the Wall Street Journal writes that, quote, even as this year has proved one of the most challenging for retailers, analysts are predicting robust holiday sales underpinned by, get this, rising wages.
That's my story and I'm sticking to it.
Yeah, you heard that right, but let's try it again. Rising wages, low unemployment, and strong consumer confidence. So yeah, with the possible exception of that last one, I have my doubts about 2 out of the 3 of those. What rising wages, says Zero Hedge. Aside from various soft surveys and management expectations, wage growth remains abysmal, especially if you account for real inflation, meaning that real wage growth has in fact been negative for a full quarter, 3 months now. And what the Wall Street Journal probably means, they continue, is that between near-record low personal savings and a surge in credit card usage, Americans are spending like there's no tomorrow. They're just not spending their own money. And before we move on from Black Friday, the retail apocalypse, and other harbingers of a society gone mad, I do want to throw this into the mix, also comes from Zero Hedge, about the second largest gun maker in the United States, which is finding itself in hard times now that Americans are no longer quite as afraid as they were of an Obama or Hitlery regime going door to door and confiscating them, or even continuing crackdowns on future sales. 2017, it says, has seen the biggest drop in American firearm sales in history. After 8 years of almost incessant rises in NICS firearms checks, a proxy for total arms sales, under the previous unconstitutional gun-controlling regimes, 2017 has seen the biggest year-to-date drop in Big Brother-approved firearm sales, the NICS check, in history. The sudden drop in demand after President Trump's election has meant that Remington, now Remington Outdoor, the second largest U.S. gun maker, has suffered a rapid and sharp deterioration in sales and a similar drop in its profits since January. And they face continued softness in consumer demand for firearms because people just aren't quite as scared as they were before. As a result, S&P has cut the company's corporate debt rating, already at junk bond level, CCC+, 2 full notches down to CCC-, because they have a backlog of unsold, unwanted firearms, which will force Remington to operate at a loss and, quote, pressure the company's sales and profitability, at least through early 2018. Sturm Ruger and American Outdoor Brands, a.k.a. Smith & Wesson, are also feeling the pain. And your cynical host, folks, notes that even a few high-profile false flag events intended to enable Big Brother to clamp down on firearm sales hasn't done the trick yet. No doubt they've got more on tap and will have the usual ineffective calls for more of the same that clearly hasn't worked except to disarm people and herd them into gun-free killing zones. Even if some of them may have gone out and bought a nice shiny new firearm to keep it home where it doesn't do much good. Maybe if the president really wanted to revitalize a truly American industry, firearms for keeping and bearing by the citizenry at large, he could advocate getting rid of the NICS check entirely. Because your host can't help but suspect that the day after that abomination was rightfully struck down, anyway would do, we'd see the biggest single-day surge in purchases in firearms in American history. Because I can't help but suspect there'd be a lot of people that would rush out, knowing there's another Hitlery out there somewhere on the horizon. Because let's be real here. If requiring Big Brother's permission in advance to buy something, and then not allowing it to be born anyway, isn't infringement, you do have to ask, what the heck is? From there we go to Big Brother's continuing and increasing public-private partnership monopoly over what was once called free speech, in what amounts to a major shift, or so it's claimed, in Twitter's policy. Mashable's Kerry Flynn reports that that particular Big Brother partner announced on Friday they will be monitoring Octung users' behavior. No, not only in things they tweet, but, quote, on and off the platform. Meaning it's not just what people tweet that they'll be looking at. Octung, we have ways of knowing what you think. It was called perhaps the most intrusive move yet, from social media platform efforts to virtue signal as much as possible and appease their public-private Big Brother regulating partners. Yes, they're cracking down on hate speech. And they'll decide, of course, what that means. And I can't help but think that if that bothers you, you're almost certainly guilty of it anyway. Listen to this from what's called an update to Twitter's Help Center. Abusive behavior. We believe in freedom of expression and open dialogue, but that means little as an underlying philosophy if voices are silenced because people are afraid to speak up. Can you believe this hypocrisy? Hey folks, now that I think of it, anybody that wants to tweet a link to this show, let me know how that works out. I'm honestly curious. Yes, in order to ensure that people feel safe expressing diverse opinions, unless obviously they're diverse opinions they don't like, we prohibit behavior that crosses the line into abuse, including behavior that harasses, intimidates, or uses fear to silence another's voice, unless it's fear of being kicked off of the Twitter platform, it seems. Context matters, they continue, when evaluating for abusive behavior and determining appropriate enforcement actions. Factors we may take into consideration include, but are not limited to, whether the behavior is targeted at an individual or a group of people, whether the behavior has been filed by the target of the abuse or a bystander, and if the behavior is newsworthy. And this does sound a bit subjective too, and in the legitimate public interest. And furthermore, Twitter reiterates that they will continue to control the stream of information even more broadly than they have before. Quote, at times, we may prevent certain content from trending. And we've already seen what that means now, haven't we? Yet another scary precedent, say people who can remember what free speech was once about. And no doubt, suggests Tyler Durden, if you're not doing anything wrong, then why would this be an issue for you? Because we're getting used to continued intrusions by the American surveillance state. And maybe, folks, as your host has been pointing out, that is precisely the point. There was at least one major speech this past week, and a proclamation along with it, that stands in stark contrast to what we've gotten used to over the last 8 years or so. And I guess you'd have to say this is unbridled good news, even something to be very thankful for. WorldNet Daily editor Joseph Farah points out that President Trump's first Thanksgiving Day proclamation, released on Friday, stands in stark contrast to the 8 issued by his predecessor, Barack Hussein Obama, the man with more aliases than any other president in U.S. history, if for no other reason than that Trump invoked God, the God of the Bible, specifically 6 times in his first proclamation, emphasizing an American tradition whose inspiration comes from the Bible, and that, of course, is more than Barry Sabarco did during his entire set of 8 annual separate proclamations, which amounted to 5, yes, you can count them on one hand, excluding a couple of quotes from George Washington and Abraham Lincoln over the years. In stark contrast to what we've seen, said Farah, Trump left no ambiguity about whom thanks should be directed. Starting with the very first paragraph, quote, on Thanksgiving Day, as we have for nearly 4 centuries, Americans give thanks to Almighty God for our abundant blessings. We gather with the people we love to show gratitude for our freedom, our friends and families, and for the prosperous nation we call home. He went on to talk about the Pilgrims and the history of this particularly American holiday, and concluded this way. Now, therefore, I, Donald J. Trump, President of the United States of America, by virtue of the authority vested in me by the Constitution and the laws of the United States, do hereby proclaim Thursday, November 23rd, 2017, as a National Day of Thanksgiving. I encourage all Americans to gather in homes and places of worship to offer a prayer of thanks to God for our many blessings. In witness whereof, I have hereunto set my hand this 17th day of November in the year of our Lord, 2017, and of the independence of the United States of America, the 242nd. From the good, we'll skip right through the bad and on to the ugly. Sadly, we can't wrap up this week without talking about the continued, scumbag revelations. Whether it's Hollywood or the Senate floor, there are plenty of really scuzzy people out there finally being revealed for what they are. From Charlie Rose to more complaints against the evil Al Franken, senior wheelchair Bush gropers, to nasty, dirty old Uncle Joe Biden, predator revelations are now coming forth like warts on witches. And in this case, Senate hypocrites are having to deal with the fact that Al Franken is still sitting in that not-so-august body. And let's not forget the repeatedly alleged serial rapist, Bill Clinton, whose crimes have been ignored by all the Washington and New York establishment literally for years now. Four new women have come forward to accuse the former president of sexual harassment in their case. Gee, who could have imagined such a thing? Typically, these are a whole lot worse accusations than anything that's even remotely been alleged against, Judge Roy Moore running for Senate in Alabama comes to mind. The hypocrites in Congress have already settled over $17 million worth of sexual harassment lawsuits in the last quarter century or so, 264 cases admitted, and yet another big one this week of Michigan Representative John Conyers, Democrat, and the longest-serving, sick, member of the House of Representatives, might even add a revealing twist. Conyers settled a sexual harassment and wrongful dismissal complaint in 2015 with a former employee who alleged she was fired because she would not, quote, succumb to his sexual advances. Documents in this case actually include signed affidavits, some of them notarized by former House staff members, who alleged that he made sexual advances to her and others. And the documents also reveal the secret mechanism by which Conyers and other scumbags in Congress have kept an unknown number of sexual harassment allegations secret. A grinding, closely held process that left the alleged victim feeling, as she told BuzzFeed News, that she had no option other than to stay quiet and accept the settlement that was offered to her. Quote, I was basically blackballed. There was nowhere I could go, she said in a phone interview. Her name is withheld for obvious reasons. But the Washington Post even now has reported that the congressional office paid out $17 million plus for those 264 settlements with federal employees. But here's the kicker, folks. The woman who settled that complaint launched in 2014 with Conyers ended up facing a daunting process that ended with a confidentiality agreement in exchange for $27,111.75 as a settlement. But get this. Her settlement came from Conyers' office budget. Isn't that amazing? Rather than the designated secret slush fund for settlements. So how many other sexual settlements have not only been kept secret, but not even taken out of the secret slush fund, already down some $17 million-plus taxpayer-funded scummy dollars? There's a whole lot more on this story that I'm going to go through, but it all makes the same disgusting point. This guy was politically correct, powerful, and therefore untouchable. And that, too, arguably goes a long way towards explaining why the WAPO leaves the likes of these scumbags alone and yet goes with tongs after anybody that threatens the deep state's entrenched power base, and their legion of crooked cover-ups. These slimy scumbags may be evil, but there's no denying they're smart, especially when it comes to covering up just how scummy and evil they really are. And did I mention they're hypocrites, too? On now, again, to the other side of a slimy coin. This one, too, comes from iBank Coin, Zero Point Now, and Zero Hedge. And it has to do with the fact that, yes, there are sexual harassment claims that come from, shall we say, unreliable sources. Often as not, the debunking of those claims, for cause, doesn't get anywhere close to the same degree of exposure, particularly when there's overwhelming political correctness at play, as the shrieking claims. Over the last several weeks, it begins accusations of sexual improprieties by Alabama Senate candidate Republican Roy Moore have led to calls, especially from hypocrites on the left, for the judge to exit the race to fill the vacancy left by arguably do-nothing Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Meanwhile, others have rushed to Roy Moore's defense, calling into question everything from the original WAPO article to accuser Beverly Young Nelson's claim that Moore showered her with unwanted attention when she was 15 and sexually assaulted her when she was only a year older. A now infamous yearbook entry from December 1977, which Nelson claims is Moore's, has come under scrutiny. Basically, everything about it seems to be a fake. Many point out that Moore's last name, title, date, and location all appear to have been added later. Forgery, if it's true. And her attorney, notorious politico Gloria Allred, has refused to confirm the authenticity of the yearbook and won't hand it over to handwriting experts unless a Senate Judiciary Committee agrees to conduct a hearing first, which you know isn't going to happen because he's not in the Senate. It's a scam request, in other words, a catch-22. And, of course, they've said they wouldn't seat him anyway because he doesn't meet their high standards. Meanwhile, the Alabama special election is just over 3 weeks away, and that seems to be the real point of all of this. This week, Moore's campaign released a number of statements from former restaurant employees poking holes in Nelson's claims, amounting to everything from the fact that she was too young, if she was really 15, to have been employed by the restaurant anyway. Old Hickory House required employees to be a minimum of 16 years old, to the restaurant's hours, to the physical layout of the restaurant, to the fact that even though the accuser claims Judge Roy Moore came in almost every night and sat at the counter, nobody else even remembers him being there. Basically, everything that amounts to debunking her claims and indicating the whole story is basically a WAPO. There are any number of stories that came out this week of other eyewitnesses debunking other parts of Nelson's. Yeah, I'll say it again. Evidently, it was a WAPO. And what they all seem to have in common is not only, arguably, their own understanding of the truth, but the fact that the waste stream fake news is pretty much ignoring them, too. Interestingly, however, polls later on in the week seemed to show that Alabama voters were seeing through it, and if anything, they were getting sick and tired of what they were constantly hearing. Last story I saw said Judge Roy Moore had a 33 percentage point lead over his opponent, literally about 66 to 33% or so, which would be over a landslide. And that would speak volumes if it was to hold, and if people were to actually go to the polls and tell the American press and deep state manipulators just exactly how sick they were of what's been going on and what people have been getting away with. Speaking of which, let's go to this story next. There's not a whole lot to it other than the fact that it's yet one more thing that's getting ignored. Why, asks IntelliHub, did so many of the Las Vegas massacre survivors mention seeing helicopters during the shooting? It seems they note as if the waste stream media has buried eyewitness reports regarding the presence of helicopters in the air during the Las Vegas shooting. And other than the fact that they just seem to like to lie, you do have to ask the question, why? Why were their reports completely ignored for no apparent reason, and they still haven't gotten that much attention? Of course, what we know now is that since the official narrative has fallen apart at the seams anyway, the waste stream is going to ignore anything and everything associated with Las Vegas to the best of their discretionary, attention-shifting, even deceptive ability. Maybe the obvious answer to the question why, though, has to do with the questions that would be raised. If there were helicopters in the air, what took so long to get others on the scene? What did the helicopters see? Why didn't they do anything if there, in fact, were lots of shooters? But maybe that's obvious. And, of course, what does all of that do to an already discombobulated timeline? Sometimes, folks, your host will joke about the fact that when you see politicians on TV, and I guess that now goes for the waste stream politicians masquerading as journalists too, and you ask the question, how do you know when they're lying? The answer remains, when their lips are moving. But now it seems, since they seem to know we know they're lying, they don't talk about certain things at all. And one of those things, of course, is what all of this is intended to distract people from. The coming and, in a lot of respects, continuing economic meltdown. We'll talk about that and some other things when we return after the bottom of the hour break. Stay with us. Yeah, you're shaking. I'm laying awake thinking about it now. I'm terrified. Never been much on religion, but I showed up with a lot to hear the call. Come on now, give me a sign you're listening to me. Welcome back now to the second half of the show. Again, I'm your host, Mark Call, and let's pick it up where I promised. Other old news is new again, too. Now we're talking market chicanery. Gold drops to key technical support and beyond, basically, after a $2 billion purge let off the holiday shortened week. Yes, says Zero Hedge here with the charts. After surging above its 50-day moving average on Friday in a big move up, it appears that someone is really keen for that key technical level not to hold, as they dumped almost $2 billion of notional value in paper contracts in mere seconds to start the week off on Monday morning, testing down to the 50-day moving average, which held for a while, but not for long. 15,000 gold contracts were dumped in just under 2 minutes. The BOP seemed to have done what it was supposed to, even though there was a bit of recovery before the holiday-shortened week was out. Gold closed the week at about $1,288 for a fiat ounce, basically still in that never-never land where things could go either way, but not in all likelihood where it would have ended up without some preemptive bopping. Meanwhile, in spite of an even worse drubbing, silver is still just barely up above $17 for a fiat ounce at the week's end. For some insight on all of this, along with the continuing manipulation and eventual ultimate and inevitable breakdown, I go to several pieces from King World News over the weekend. First one's from Bill Fleckenstein, who noted several really bizarre things that happened last week. Two, in fact, particularly insane. One of them, the sale for a Da Vinci painting at almost $500 million. Yeah, you heard that right. The most expensive price paid for a painting in human history. Well, in fiat dollars, anyway. $450 million for a single painting at a Christie's auction in New York. Many of which, he noted, would have qualified for the Mania Chronicles, version 3.0, if I'd decided to document them. That wasn't all. Yesterday, he noted, over the weekend, a Parisian triple B-rated company, in other words, quasi-junk, issued $500 million too, at a coincidentally similar number, in three-year notes, yielding a whopping minus 0.026%. Now, wait a second, folks. Who's lining up to buy stuff like that? We've been peppered, he says, lately with so many absurdities that nothing really seems absurd anymore, although people can be assured that when folks look back at this period, they'll probably wonder, what were they thinking? And by then, the list of examples will be quite long. The second story from King World News was an interview with James Turk, who's also noting the insanity in the markets and the continued manipulation. He expects that the recent moves in gold and silver indicate that eventually they'll be, quote, ready to fly. He was encouraged, like many others were, by the big moves up in the gold and silver markets last week, which obviously helps explain the bop today. But for now, don't forget the manipulation. Quote, eventually the markets are always more powerful than central banks, says Turk. Eventually the markets do take over, and it's just sort of my sense that after waiting so patiently for so long, the markets are going to gain the upper hand. Unquote. Evidently, though, don't hold your breath. Trouble is, as the evil fiat economist and father of government deficit spending, for whom Keynesianism is named, pointed out, markets can remain irrational longer than you can remain solvent. Meaning in this environment, of course, the manipulators can get away with it for longer than you might have thought possible. And that when the inevitable breakdown happens, that might be worse than most of us would have ever thought possible, too. I've got one more interview here from over the weekend, also via King World News, of one of my favorites from Matterhorn Asset Management in Switzerland, Egon von Greyers. We'll come back to most of his comments in a second, but he does indicate that for the third time in recent weeks, a Swiss bank has refused to hand over clients' gold. At least the clients thought it was their gold. This week, he says, I was contacted by a person who went to his bank in Zurich, one of the two largest in Switzerland, and tried to get his physical gold out. He'd seen my articles on the subject, but his bank, and he just simply says it's one of the biggest asset management banks in the world, told him no, he couldn't have his gold because the bank has new rules. But the man, to his credit, didn't give up that easily. He then asked for a letter from the bank confirming that they refused to hand his gold over to him, and he told the banksters that he would take that letter to the police, whereupon they clearly got scared, and after making him wait for 3 hours, the gentleman was told by the bank that, yeah, they would hand over his gold to him. So generous of them, says Egon von Greyers, to hand back the client's own asset. But it does confirm that most banks are simply not going to give their clients back what they thought was theirs without a major legal fight. And all of that, he says, is just the first stage of what's going on. Soon banks will be under such pressure that they will hold on to clients' assets. And of course, as we've seen in the EU, folks, when it comes to paper assets, they have a legal right to do so. Now that depositors have been reduced to unsecured creditors, it's called a bail-in. And yes, the same applies in the U.S. and Canada, and it's simply going to get worse. Says Von Greyers, I urge people to just get their assets out of the banks, whether it's in Switzerland or any other country. Because the financial system is already bankrupt, regardless of what the central bank chiefs try to tell you. Here, while we're still talking about the gold manipulation and most recent bop, I go to one of the best technical analysts, in my opinion, in the business, Clive Mond, who looks at a number of charts and says, the gold charts are actually, at least up until this morning, they were quite bullish, especially the two-year chart. The dollar index, though, also looks bullish, especially in the latest hedgers chart. So how do we reconcile what seem to be contradictory pieces of information? Well, with difficulty, that's how. Here, says Clive Mond, we should note that it's possible for the dollar and gold to rally together, although this is a rare event that would involve gold outpacing the dollar, which could happen if, for example, money flooded out of Europe and into the U.S. as a relative safe haven, and also into gold for the same reason. One scenario that's considered quite likely is gold rallying up within its uptrend channel to the band of resistance between $1,360 and $1,380 an ounce, an area where an extreme COT, which stands for Commitment of Traders, which he follows extensively, develops, and it's not too far off, before eventually it stalls out and drops again. An effective strategy, he says, for pragmatic traders to play this situation is to be long precious metals now, following the buy signal on Friday, and then to start taking profits when gold arrives in the resistance level between 1360 and 1380, especially if it makes it all the way to the upper boundary of their two-year chart channel. But beware the lower boundary of the channel, he says, especially if the manipulators, I note here, manage to break gold below the support level at about $1,260 an ounce. All of which your host hopes helps explain the huge paper short sales we're seeing at play today, and which we've seen before, I don't know, maybe 100 times before, over and over and over again. It's crooked as all get out, and I'm sure we'll see some more stories over the next few days about just how crooked this particular bop has been. But for right now, anyway, the key to note is that gold, as I'm doing the recording, is down almost $20, about 1.4%. Silver has been bopped even harder. It's down 2.5%, which is a huge move on the day. Almost 45 cents, and yes, it's again below that key $17 for the fiat paper version anyway. Clive Mond, who was at least for a while among the number of technical analysts that were skeptical of just how crooked the markets really were, but seems to have awakened to it, says, finally, it's worth pointing out that we're perfectly well aware of the price suppression of gold being undertaken in the paper market as the physical supply continues to tighten, and that the Chinese and the Russians are wisely taking the opportunity this presents to vacuum up much of the West gold on the cheap, so that later, and quite possibly at a time of their choosing, they'll be able to bury the dollar and forcibly put the self-appointed global policeman with its 700-plus military bases around the world out to grass as a result of its being economically ground into the dust. I guess you could call that a warning, folks. At that time, continues Mond, when the Chinese may back the yuan with gold, gold will reassume its central and traditional role and is likely to soar due to the extremely high level of paper assets relative to gold. A growing awareness of the raw power that China now wields is the reason why the U.S. has suddenly started being nice to China, which has noted and learned the lessons from the U.S. treatment of Russia. And one more quick tidbit here, where an unlikely source, Bank of America, is even admitting the meltdown is inevitable. In their analysis for the first half of 2018, B of A is warning investors of a flash crash like the ones in 1987, 94, and 98. And it warns, too, that central bank policies have created the current conditions, they can't be reversed, and all of that leads not only to a crash, but an inevitable war thereafter. And would you believe they're even suggesting people buy gold? Back then to the Egon von Greyer's interview, who summarizes a similar set of observations and what's going on in the world this way. What's absolutely certain, he says, is that global wealth will be totally decimated over the next 4 to 8 years. Doesn't matter if you're very rich or just own a house with some equity left. Most of it will come down in value, he believes, by between 75% over the next few years as the debt and asset bubbles implode. But what very few people realize or plan for is the confiscation of wealth that will take place over those same coming years. It'll be on many levels, he says, because with times deteriorating, governments will be thrown out as ordinary people become dissatisfied with their rapidly declining ability to even survive. Many people will lose their jobs, and government's ability to help the poor and hungry will decline rapidly due to falling tax revenues. During that process, opposition parties will, of course, promise the earth. Thus, we'll see a societal upheaval due to political turbulence, social unrest, dire economic circumstances, as well as anarchy. He thinks more and more parties in the West have and will continue to turn socialist or communist in latter years. That will continue as the climate deteriorates. The trouble is, normal people at this stage will become so poor it won't serve any purpose for government to tax them, so the obvious target will be the wealthy. And socialist governments looking for more revenue will ensure that most of their remaining wealth, too, will also disappear. Taxes will reach confiscatory levels of at least 75% to perhaps 90%, which might be popular with ordinary people who at that point will be poor and suffering, but it'll be what the desperate masses will demand, whether it's done peacefully or with violence. Meanwhile, what's been done in Saudi Arabia by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman when it comes to confiscation of the wealth of other Saudi princes and businessmen might set an example. Governments in the UK, Germany, or even the US could just decide to freeze the assets of the wealthy and issue arrest warrants demanding transfer of, say, 85% of their wealth. And refusal won't be an option since it would lead to a long prison sentence plus confiscation of 100% of it. I hope, he concludes, none of this will happen. But when you look at risks and probabilities, we're clearly at a point in history when these events are likely to take place. And this gap we see between the rich and the poor cannot continue without returning eventually to the mean. So the time to think about it is now, while there is still time. This seems like a good week for a little bit of conspiracy theory follow-up, since more and more of the conspiracy theories of years past have turned out to be actual fact, and a conspiracy besides. Starting, of course, with the reason for which the CIA, decades ago, coined the term conspiracy theory, and that was the assassination and cover-up of JFK that turned out to be one of the premier conspiracy theories in U.S. history. Building on that success, today we have, thanks to Big Brother and the Deep State, more conspiracy theories than ever. More alternatives for exposing them, too, at least while the web isn't yet completely under Big Brother's control. So let's talk about a few of them, new and old, while we still can. From one of the major sources of so many of them, Hillary Clinton, let's start here. Judicial Watch has uncovered yet more new evidence of FBI leadership panicking over clear, obvious, and undeniable conflicts of interest when it came to the so-called Clinton email. Well, you know, they like the term matter rather than investigation, because if there's one thing we now know for sure, investigation it wasn't. On Tuesday this week, conservative watchdog Judicial Watch released another 79 pages of Just Us Department records showing FBI leadership discussions about even what they perceived as conflicts of interest with the Hillary Clinton email scandal so-called investigation. According to Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton, they obtained emails from a FOIA lawsuit filed back on July 24th, related this time to FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe's involvement with his wife's political campaign and another Hitler-related conflict of interest and one of so many parts to that big cover-up. About that same time, The Hill's John Solomon revealed that the FBI director gave Hillary Clinton's email investigation what was called special status. And, of course, the FBI refuses to clarify what McCabe meant by labeling the so-called Clinton probe special. McCabe just claimed it was special, and he wasn't given any details about it. Meanwhile, ranking member of the House Judiciary Committee, Congressman Gates of Florida, told Laura Ingraham on Tuesday evening, "I am immediately calling for an investigation into the special treatment that the FBI gave to Hillary." This, too, one more related piece of information about the dreaded Rusky cover-up. No, the real story was never about Trump, as it turned out. That was a typical blame-shifting tactic. Although the waste stream still won't report on it, it was Hitlery and Uranium One all along. And the weak smoking gun came from a letter written by United States Senator John Barrasso from Wyoming to Obama all the way back on December 21st of 2010, informing him in no uncertain terms that Uranium One was in fact controlled by the Russian government. They were grabbing U.S. nuclear stock, and Obama, of course, approved it anyway. If the press had even a fraction of the integrity that they once did, like during the Tricky Dick Nixon impeachment era, we'd be hearing questions like, what did they know and when did they know it? There was a conspiracy, all right, and it made anything Tricky Dick ever dreamed of pale by comparison, and not just when it comes to enemies list and political use of the IRS. Which may be a good reminder that when it comes to conspiracies and criminality within the U.S. government's highest ranks, much of the deep state was just perfecting old techniques. Case in point, and this one actually dates back decades. Yes, it's a new story about an old conspiracy theory, long since revealed as fact, from Matt Agarus at the Activist Post. Declassified top secret documents reveal plans for the U.S. to obtain Soviet aircraft and then use them to attack Americans. It's called a false flag, and it was intended to be a pretext to start a war. As the deep state continues, says Matt, to push the Russian election interference narrative with no concrete evidence, the damage to U.S.-Russian relations continues to grow. And sadly, those who continue to buy into the Russiagate conspiracy theory have forgotten the U.S. government's history when it comes to propaganda used to start wars and bolster the military-industrial complex. A recent revelation from the newly released JFK files can now help put this entire Russian hacking scenario into context, as it's been the subject of multiple previous propaganda campaigns. On March 22, 1962, a meeting held by the Special Group Augmented, which according to an encyclopedia on the CIA, included Attorney General Robert Kennedy, CIA Director John McCone, National Security Advisor McGeorge Bundy, and Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff Lyman Lemnitzer, discussed the creation of a false flag attack on the United States to be blamed on the Soviets. And according to the documents, the U.S. government wanted to manufacture or obtain Soviet aircraft so they could launch that attack on America or friendly bases and then use those attacks as a pretext for, guess what, folks, they're still trying to do this, get a war started. The official documents noted that the plans for the attacks were approved and the Joint Chiefs merely needed to pick one of the 9 separate pretexts that they had outlined to sucker U.S. citizens into that war. The document said, quote, we could develop a communist Cuban terror campaign in the Miami area or in other Florida cities, even in Washington. The terror campaign could be pointed at Cuban refugees seeking haven in the United States. We could sink a boatload of Cubans en route to Florida, real or simulated. We could foster attempts on the lives of Cuban refugees in the United States, even to the extent of wounding in instances to be widely publicized. Hey, I guess they owned the media then, too, didn't they? Exploding a few plastic bombs in carefully chosen spots, the arrest of a Cuban agent, and the release of prepared documents, substantiating Cuban involvement. Sounds like they knew how to put fingerprints on things, even then, too, doesn't it? All of that, it said, would be helpful in projecting the idea of an irresponsible government, unquote. And no, folks, they're not talking about an irresponsible government in Washington, you understand. And, of course, the bottom line here, says Matt Agarus, is when you read all of these documents, one should be naturally inclined to start questioning every single war, especially of late, that America's ever entered, because it's become perfectly clear the U.S. government doesn't care about deceiving its own citizens, much less killing innocent people, so that they can send our brothers, sisters, mothers, and fathers off to other countries to die, so that the fat cats in D.C. can keep on doing, well, what it's obvious today, that they've been doing, and certainly seem to intend to continue. And one other thing ought to be obvious, but certainly bears repeating, especially in the current historic context, John F. Kennedy didn't go along with this, and somebody killed him, and a whole lot of other people covered it up. And by now, one thing ought to be beyond clear. In the intervening 50-plus years, they've only gotten better at all of that. Which means the rest of us need to be better at connecting the dots, rejecting certain clear contradictions, and in general, being a bit more skeptical of what we hear from the fake news. Here's an interesting story as well. May raise a few eyebrows and probably asks more questions than it answers. IntelliHub reports that Fire Captain John Lord, who has a lot of experience in looking at fires, is really, really skeptical about the official story concerning the major set of recent California fires and how they started. He's not alone. A number of people have suggested arson, or multiple acts of arson, as the proximate cause. But in this case, he says the fire spread to over 16 locations and even crossed an 8-lane highway before burning down an entire Kmart store in just hours. Cars were found melted, houses were found dustified, and basically, a whole lot of this looks really, really suspicious to a guy with lots of experience at things like this that basically just don't happen naturally. Not only is he discounting even normal kinds of arson, given the incredible temperatures, the rates at which the fire spread, and the unprecedented complete destruction of so many structures, he was willing to go publicly out on kind of an unusual limb, and even suggest that high-tech weaponry may have been involved with governmental sources. Let's start to wrap things up today with yet one more conspiracy theory that, of course, those of us with a background in science, engineering, and aviation have understood, was never really what the waste stream was trying to get you to believe it was all along anyway. Yes, Virginia, there are chemtrails, although you can't say that, you know. It has to be called geoengineering. And these chemtrails aren't to be confused with condensation trails either. If you understand the mechanisms involved in condensation from water vapor associated with jet exhaust and what happens when high temperatures meet very low temperatures, and when it happens and when it doesn't, it's real easy to tell those two different things apart. Well, last week, without too much fanfare, politicians and members of various fields convened for the U.S. House Subcommittee on Environment and the Subcommittee on Energy hearings, discussing everything from funding the controversial sky-spraying operations to, maybe, closely regulating them to prevent significant damage to the public. One concern, said Committee Chairman Lamar Smith during the hearing, is that brightening clouds could alter rain patterns, making it rain more in some places or less in others. We still do not know, said the Congress critter, enough about this subject to thoroughly understand the pros and cons of these types of technologies, unquote. Types of technologies that have been called conspiracy theories but now are being openly discussed, and yes, it is called geoengineering. Some describe it as kind of a coming-out party for the entire geoengineering industry, and the hearing also acted as a way to legitimize the field and gain more federal funding from, this time, the Trump administration. As the Sacramento Bee reported, Philip Roche and Joseph Mashkut are two climate specialists who testified last Wednesday on the potential for geoengineering, that's a catch-all for proposals to directly cool the atmosphere or pull carbon emissions from it. One idea gaining traction, the story said, is to seed marine clouds with salt water or other particles. Keyword there, folks, is other particles, increasing their potential to reflect solar rays and cool the Earth, whether or not, folks, it really needs more of that or not. It's part of the nascent and controversial branch of science, said the article, known as SRM, or sunlight reflection methods. Rash, chief scientist for the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory in Richmond, Washington, said, "We think SRM could buy time for other carbon reduction measures to be put in place," unquote. I guess it's okay if you're a conspiracy theorist and you realize just how many billions of bucks can be made by geoengineering to badmouth somebody else with that moniker if they realize what you've been doing. The key must be to manipulate the press and sell it to a gullible public properly. Said Mashkut, if the worst-case scenarios of global warming, sick, come to pass, these technologies could be used to help people, saving lives and economies from the worst effects of climate change, unquote. Or, folks, this could be exactly the kind of climate change that mankind has been idiotically doing for a long time. And as people like Dan Wigington of geoengineeringwatch.org have been pointing out for literally years now, may have already done incredible amounts of damage, all the while denying it was even possible. Yep, nothing new under the sun. Which means, your host concludes, that it's particularly important, as the Bible says, for all of us to know the times and the seasons.